Aye. Well, I just want to say to begin with that it just to, because it helps me actually, I've been spending the last year trying to write a book on ritual. So to come and be with a lot of people is kind of weird, really. So it's a little bit strange to be coming out and sort of giving a talk. But I'm very happy to do it because, well, you know, it's helping get some of the ideas that I've been sort of gestating at home out into the order, you know, to have some sort of effect. I'll just say a little bit about my background. I was ordained in 1997, and the first thing I really got my teeth into was the Manchester Buddhist Centre Festivals Committee, and along with Vidyamala and Guna Ketu, we sort of brought the thing, festivals alive again, and I suppose I developed things through that. Then later on, I've been involved with Buddhafield on the ritual side. So me and Akashati and others sort of design rituals and things for hundreds of people. So I'm sort of like used to shouting at 300 people in a field, but to be giving a talk to you lot is a bit different. So yeah. So I do feel honoured, actually. I feel honoured. Thank you. I'm going to try and keep this down to about 40 minutes because I'm aware that it's the first night and you just arrived and everything. What I want to do is to set up the weekend. We've got a weekend on ritual and devotion, on imagination, sadhana and puja is the title. So I want to sort of try and set the scene a bit with that. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say with some of it. Some of it, I'm not quite sure. I'll have to see how it goes. Okay, so I'm going to talk about mindfulness of reality. Mindfulness of reality. So I'm going to talk about the four foundations of mindfulness to start with. I'm going to then sort of talk about how mindfulness of reality, it comes to us through symbolism, through symbols, through myths, through archetypes, that sort of thing. I'm going to talk a bit about what I think that is, which is basically some form of play, adult play. I'm going to go into a little bit how to work with that or what that means in detail, and then just make some general points just about the various sort of observations that things I've thought of this year and some practical stuff about the weekend at the end. Okay, so mindfulness of reality. Mindfulness of reality through play and poetry is the title. Yeah. So basically, the four foundations of mindfulness, we've got rupa, vedana, citta, and dharma. So rupa is like the shape that your experience takes. Vedana is how that feels, whether it's pleasant or painful. And I think those two are just, you could say, all of your experience is those two. And then citta is how you respond to that, is how you sort of respond. And dharma is, well, it's your view of what reality or, you know, life is going to give you outside, you know, what's going to come from outside. And, this mindfulness of reality thing is a sort of active process. So we have to actually, we have to work at citta as well, but mindfulness of reality, we have to actually sort of work at it. And one of the things that we do is we create what we call a sacred space. So we create something like this shrine room or the Buddhafield tent. And the thing that makes it a sacred space is that we have some symbol of what we think is reality in it. So we have our locus picture here. And it's like that with any sacred space. There is some sort of, well, a space that is sacred to the people who think of it as a sacred space. So we think this is a sacred space, but perhaps for some people in America, Wall Street is a sacred space. So it's like their symbols are these huge, great buildings, which are sort of saying, well, materialism is the way to go. And, you know, we all know about Christianity and Islam and everything. And I was sort of thinking about the whole thing of, like, well, what do you do, you know, when you're in somebody else's sacred space? When you're in a what do we do when we're in a church? And I thought, well, a sacred space is where people are trying to work something out. They're trying to work something out in relation to that reality that they have in there. So it's really important to sort of leave them to do it. Just let them do that. But at the same time, you need to kind of work out, well, what is your sacred space? And sort of protect it and add to it and embellish it and everything. So, you know, we've got two kind of major sacred spaces here. We've got the shrine room and we've got the Buddhafield tent. So, I mean, I trained as a physicist, well, I did a physics degree. So my sort of path to doing this sort of thing has come through actually not being sort of brought up in art and that sort of thing, but having to sort of work at my understanding of what it all was. So in a way, I'm still trying to do that. And so part of like what I do is that I think about things and I've been thinking about, how symbolism evolved. And the thing I came up with was, it's man is different from the animals in two particular ways. One is he's kind of godlike in the sense that he's able to make things like tools, fire. He's able to sort of manipulate the form in the universe. And, animals can't really do this. So I thought, well, you know, how did that, you know, how does that work sort of thing? I thought, well, actually, you know, if you think of like prehistoric man, and all the animals are running around and everything. And an animal would just be so sort of occupied with like either getting food or running away from predators that it would be so sort of in the present moment but without any sort of reflective quality to that. So it, whatever its experience was, it would just be its experience. So say when a bit of lightning would hit the hillside and turn it onto, turn the sort of dry brush into fire, the animal wouldn't think, oh, fire. It would just run away from that experience. But at some point, I think, man began to abstract from his experience. So he began to sort of abstract out concepts like heat, you know, there's hot hillside, hot sun, oh, something similar, the hot body. And then he was able to then put that abstraction into something and make something new. So he made fire. Same with tools, you know, took a bone like the ape in 2001 and starts hitting another ape on the head with it. You know, he abstracted something and then he put it back and made something. So it makes him kind of godlike in a way. Okay, so that's one way that he's different. Another way he's different is that he has things like religion and culture. I thought, well, how does that work? Well, I suppose man would, walking around on the plane and everything, and he's kind of getting better at mastering his environment, he would have more, he would be less preoccupied with just survival. And some of the things that were basically unknowable, so he wouldn't really know what was under the earth down there, and he wouldn't really know what was up there apart from what he could see, the stars and stuff like that. So there's a sort of a movement out to, well, he'd start to sort of see various shapes to the universe. An example of this is something like, well, the sun shines on him and it makes him feel good. One of his tribe gives him something and that makes him feel good. So he's got this thing, this shape to the universe, which is good, but he can't make anything out of it. He can't make a good. But it's significant to him. So what he then seems to have done is create something to put it in. He can't put it in something real because it would be the same thing. So he has to make something abstract to put it in. So he puts it in a stone circle or an abstract shape. So, you know, like good is that, isn't it? You know, that's a sort of symbol. It's an abstract shape, it's an abstraction, it's an abstract gesture. So, you know, man began to create symbols that, well, starting with a stone circle, that helped him somehow be mindful of some of this sort of stuff to do with the universe, the patterns in it, you know, to do that brought him benefit. So the concept of good, so, you know, the things that were good brought him benefit. So it was important for him to sort of remind himself of that. So he made something. And then worshipped it. So it's like valuing it. I thought, well, carrying on this line, what about God then? How did he come up with God? What could God be like a symbol for? I thought, if you look at God, God sort of decides what happens to you in the future, in going to some religions. So maybe God is just a symbol for your future experience. So, you know, if the belief in a sort of angry God would sort of be you'd think the shape of the universe would be that you'd better behave yourself, or it's a harsh universe, and a sort of munificent God is sort of, it's a more, you know, the universe will tend to sort of be kinder to you. And we have this, don't we, you know, it's the law of karma. So we sort of believe that, you know, our actions have consequences, and we'll get a good result from being skillful. Theistic religion stops at God, the God, creator gods. But Buddhism goes further because it goes beyond the symbol. So we have the finger pointing at the moon, which is about not taking that symbol, God, literally, but it's just something to help you sort of think about reality. So in the Diamond Sutra, it says, the Buddha says, the Tathagata is not to be seen by means of his possession of marks. Otherwise, a universal monarch would be a Tathagata, a or a wheel-turning king would be a Tathagata. And I think what this is another, it's another finger pointing at the moon. It's like saying, well, the Buddha is not to be known by the abstract shape of the rupa or whatever it is, or whatever is in our imagination. He's beyond that. He's beyond form. So that picture there, it's as if it is a kind of play version or an out-of-focus version or something like that of something behind it, which is too much for us to know, really. It's ineffable. We can't grasp it. To grasp it, it has to be formed. So we've got an abstract form there, which is a route to it. It's a route for our imagination to something. But that thing is beyond, really. So, you know, one of the things that we can end up doing with symbolism is that we just look at the surface. We just end up looking at the surface, and we get used to the sort of things around us, and we stop looking through it to the mystery beyond. And I think, you know, when we do puja, it's like that. It can be like that. All that poetry is trying to get us to sort of go beyond it. You know, all poetry tries to get, all metaphor tries to get you to go into a space which is where you're looking beyond. And well, it's just a natural human tendency, really, to just sort of kind of be a bit lazy and just stop at the surface. So, you know, I think that's where things symbols start getting taken literally. Well, a symbol really is like, it's like play. So, what I mean by that is, well, if you look at children, if you think of children playing, and you know, think of a game they play, like doctors and nurses or something. So what they're doing is they're playing doctors and nurses, and they're pretending to deal with illness and death and looking after other people. And, you know, it's tomato ketchup rather than real blood. Well, you know, what do they get from that? What do they get from playing? And you know, they don't learn any facts or anything like that. But what they do is they get, they somehow, in a sort of very scaled down version, get a rehearsal of the actual situation that they're playing at, that they're going to have to face at some point. So it's a bit like, they rehearse the emotions that might be there in that situation. So in a way, it's like they're transforming. It's like, you know, it takes them a little bit closer to perfect emotion because their emotion is becoming that bit more, it's taken in reality a bit more. So I think you know, we can play with the idea of play, you know, in terms of what we're doing on this weekend. So for instance, you know, we're doing the puja. We're doing Sevenfold Puja. And the sort of things we're saying, do we actually believe them as we're saying them? You know, are they actually, you know, are they true for us? You know, the things we're saying about, all the offerings we make and all that sort of stuff. Bodhicharya Vatara, puja, all that sort of thing. Well, obviously not. You know, we're not at the stage where, in saying those things, we would actually be being truthful and be totally relaxed about saying them. So it must be something else. And I think what it is that we're playing as if we are advanced bodhisattvas. Through doing that, through playing like that, we rehearse something. You know, we rehearse the path to enlightenment in our imagination. We start off with, we come into a sacred space, and the first thing we do in the Sevenfold Puja is we try and bring in the transcendental into that space in the worship section. So we say all this sort of poetry, and I think what that's trying to do is, when you hold some poetry up to the Buddha, or you hold a flower up to the Buddha, whatever it is, you make an offering. It's like saying, in some way, you are like this. You know, you are like this flower. You are like this poetry, but you're much beyond it. You know, so you're trying to. So it's like a process of trying to bring in the transcendental. And then, you know, as you go through the puja, there's a whole process whereby you're rehearsing you kind of coming under the influence of the transcendental. You coming under the influence of the transcendental. You acting differently. You getting wise. You applying your wisdom through compassion in the transference of merit section. And even at the end, with the mantras, you being among... not just the same as the Buddha, but an individual in a community of enlightened individuals. You know, all the different bodhisattvas at the end is like sort of a representation of you being there at the end. You know, it's like a story, really. It's like a sort of film or something, and you end up in there. You know, you bring in the transcendental at the beginning, and you end up as the transcendental. But you're playing at it. You're playing at it. But in playing at it, you somehow get closer to it. You know, you somehow sort of move in that direction. Yeah. So, I'm kind of aware, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, the whole thing of... different people, you know, different people with different, whose imaginations seem to work in different ways. And, you know, some people are kind of visual types, and some sort of like sport, you know, and some people like music, and there's a whole range of different sort of preferences that people have. So, you know, like when it comes to puja and things, different people will have different preferences. Some people are going to prefer Padmasambhava's approach. Some it'll be Avalokiteshvara. There'll be all these different, and I think it's somehow tied in with the kind of language that you speak, what sort of person you are, and you know, you have to kind of go a bit with what's familiar, be led a bit with what's familiar towards what is more unfamiliar. So in the blurb about this weekend, I sort of said a bit about that, different people with different imaginations, you know, types of imagination. And I just wanted to say a little bit about, it's like it's not just a little bit about the whole thing of like visualizing and that sort of thing. So I think the main thing is that you've got something to move towards. So an image, imagination, it's like image. The image is what appears to you as a clear path forward. So say for an artist, it might be they come across a shape in a gallery and they go, wow, you know, it's like a combination of shapes or something, colours. A dancer, it might be a feeling of energy that they have in their body that actually is like, oh, they know where to go, they know the way forward. You know, I think for like a general, it's like it's all tangibles, it's all sort of shapes of, or you know, maybe a centre chairman or something like that. It's like dealing with the tangible, the tangible kind of hard rock-like, you know, kind of things. And it's like you're able to do that because you speak that language, you know. So I just wanted to say, like, we've got a common. We're all imagining, but we might do it in very, very different ways. So yeah, it's just like having some imagination about that, you know, that what are, you know, how do different people operate, and having a sense that yeah, it's all part of the same thing, you know. So what for one, what you know, so we don't tread on each other's sacred spaces, you know. So for one person, you know, it might be one thing that they like, and somebody else likes something else. So it's like tolerance is about just sort of trying to understand that, or trying to sort of give that person that space. So I'll just, I'm coming up to 40 minutes. So I'll just say a little bit about kind of practical things to do with what we're actually going to be doing on the weekend. So, you know, I was saying a bit before about this collective practice. I wasn't saying about that at all. I was saying about playing at being advanced bodhisattvas. So, you know, when we're doing the pujas over the weekend, this is what we can do. So instead of getting into the situation maybe that happens sometimes where we're repeating something after the leader, but there's this little doubt in the back of our minds, oh, I don't really believe this, you know, it's like it's not really me sort of thing. Don't bother with that. Just sort of let yourself believe, pretend that you actually mean it. As a skillful, you know, as a sort of means to actually play with it and get something from being that, you know, imagining being that person. So in a way, if you do that, you will get some sort of experience, some glimmering of what being a bodhisattva is. The other really interesting thing is, I think, if we're practicing together. So what's the play aspect of that? What's the interesting bit of that? Well, you know, we can imagine each other as advanced bodhisattvas and try and believe that. So when somebody's chanting is irritating us or something, or whatever it is, when there's something going on which is bringing it away from that play aspect, just don't bother with it. Just sort of, you know, just play at being at what you might imagine a room full of bodhisattvas would be like with each other, and how they'd feel towards each other. And just let that sort of imprint on you in some sort of way. So, you know, is a bodhisattva going to get tense when they're doing a puja? You know, they're not, you know. They're just going to be sort of, oh, this is me, you know, this is great, you know, this is what I do, you know. And this is what I do all day long. So this is why we've got stuff all day long. It's just to give us a sort of chance to, well, you know, just to play, really. And actually, you know, give us a rest from the reality, you know, whatever the reality might be, you know, because, you know, it's not going to be up to that, is it? It's, you know, it's not going to be up to that. So I think actually playing at being in harmony in a puja actually leads to more harmony, because you're actually rehearsing it and you kind of get to know what it is, you know. But you have to actually do it. You do have to actually do the playing. Yeah. And one thing I find, if I get a bit, if I'm in a sometimes in a difficult sort of state of mind or something, and I'm doing a puja, and I think the tendency sometimes can be to want to sort of force it or sort of create something and strain a bit. And I don't think that is, well, that's not really what you do when you're playing, do you? You don't strain when you're playing. And I thought, well, what I do that in those situations is just say the words. Just say the words. And pay attention to the detail of the words. So just that as a mindfulness exercise, just following. Just da-da-da, whatever the leader's doing, just do exactly the same. And in some way, that poetry will go in. It's like you don't have to do anything with it, really. It's coming from outside of you, so it will kind of imprint on you. So hopefully, if we can sort of do some of this tomorrow, we'll kind of have a bit of a different experience. So, what we've got is we've got, I'll just sort of say what's going to happen over the weekend. We've got, at 10:30 tomorrow, there's a selection of different pujas. So, in here, there's a puja to Manjugosha, and in the Butterfield Shrine tent, there's a Padmasambhava puja. So I really encourage you, if you haven't been in the Butterfield tent, to actually have the experience over the weekend. I think what a lot of people find is that being in a tent, it makes it easier to meditate in some way. And being on just carpet with the sound of the wind outside, it's quite conducive, really. So, and especially if you're doing a Padmasambhava puja. So we've got two pujas going on, and then there's three different workshops. Vasantra's doing one on sadhana, I'm doing one on puja, on the sevenfold puja, and Moksha-jyoti is going to do one for people who find, who sort of don't really click with devotion. Yeah, Moksha-jyoti's good, actually. He said, I don't really like puja, but I'm very devotional, I like helping people. So there's different ways of being devotional. So he's going to do that. And then through the day, there are more different pujas. And in the evening, in the afternoon, Vasantra is going to lead the order sadhana, and then the order metta. And we've got a talk from Prakasha. And tomorrow evening's dedicated to Ariadarkani. And a Padmasambhava puja afterwards. So, okay. So I've said a bit of theoretical stuff, and I've said a bit of a few ideas that I've sort of come up with in terms of working with puja. And I've just said a bit about the programme. I suppose... maybe just a little bit about how to approach the weekend. One of the things I was leading the morning meditations on Butterfield North in the summer, and I used part of my book, and it seemed to work quite well. And there was a thing about I came up with to do with letting go, letting fantasy and letting go. So fantasy is like. It's pretending, isn't it? And, well, what are some fantasy figures? So you've got sort of like nature spirits, you've got like fairies and goblins and all that sort of thing. And, you know, people in Butterfield get into this sort of stuff. well, I thought, well, you know, what is that? You know, what is, here we go again, irrational, you know, what is that? And, well, I thought, well, actually, what happens? It says to enter into fairyland, you have to ride on the wind, or you kind of go on down the river or something, or enter into the woods. So there's some sort of letting go into nature. There's a letting go into nature, and what happens? Well, fairies appear, which you could say is like, well, something magical happens. So magic comes, you know. But I thought, well, actually, it's a bit more than that. It's probably letting, if you let go, but you look after yourself. So you let go, but you have metta and mindfulness, but particularly metta. Let go into nature. Let go into how you're feeling. Then, and have metta. Then, it's like trusting, isn't it? And something can come from nowhere. Something magical can happen. So this is what I'm hoping in, you know, that the weekend will be like, that something magical will happen that comes from you don't know where, but. I think, first of all, you've got to let go into it. Let go into the puja, let go into being with each other, let go into the space you've got here. And yeah, just trust it's going to work. Okay. So, just the final point. We've got there are a whole load of pujas, but at the moment we've got two leaders for them. So, there are actually seven pujas we haven't got leaders for. And there's also a tea ceremony, which would be nice to have somebody organise that wanted to do that. I've put a list up on the board if anyone wants to sort of do a puja. But basically what we're going to do, it's a bit like trusting, we're going to sort of leave the puja texts, nice laminated here, Song to Amitabha. On the podium thing, and well, if it happens, it happens. So that's it. Interesting. Thank you very much. That's all.